we are gone and forgotten, our buildings will keep on proclaiming that here have lived people who had a heart for the needs of children. Reverend Klein, 1929.
Even though the buildings are gone, my son Andy and I have uncovered the long-forgotten stories of the people who lived there, worked there, and died there. They were at the same time ordinary and extraordinary, and we hope you will be inspired by the sacrifices they made. By sharing their stories, we ensure that the people who had a heart for the needs of children will be remembered. Welcome to The Homes. My name is Karen Thaliker.
And I'm Andrew Newell. We're your hosts as we explore the challenges and joys of life at an institution housing orphans and old folks in rural Iowa during the year 1929. Welcome to October of 1929. The month begins with news of a scientific and aviation triumph for Fritz von Opel. Von Opel was the grandson of a famous German industrialist and was fascinated by space and rockets. He had previously built a rocket-powered car and motorcycle, but on October 1, 1929, newspapers across the country printed his first-hand account of what it was like to be the first person to fly a rocket-powered airplane that day before. "Thus I race into space as in a dream," von Opel wrote, "without any feeling for space or time. The machine practically flies itself. I scarcely need to touch the wheel. I only feel the boundless, intoxicating joy of making a flight such as man has never made before."
Back on Earth, and more specifically on Burlington Road, the final months of the year were busy for the Homes. The October newsletter declared, "Harvest time is at hand. We are still very busy picking tomatoes and expect a very good harvest. Our bee man, John Aiden, is busy harvesting. Up to now, he has delivered 240 pounds of honey to the cooks. Both young and old will certainly enjoy this next winter. The older men who are able and willing to work are busy turning the fallen apples into cider. They have made 100 gallons, which is being enjoyed by all. When it is hard, there will still be enough for vinegar to supply our homes." Mrs. Arndt, who today is celebrating her 81st birthday, and Mrs. Gerard are always busy making shirts. They have made 200, which have been sold for $100, and turned the money into the treasury of the Homes. They are happy to be able to do this for their homes, even though they are old. May we add that these ladies have a charming pattern for making a delightful little handkerchief holder in the shape of a small shirt. They sell these for 50 cents a piece each and are well worth it. Send 50 cents to either one of these ladies in care of the Lutheran Homes, and they will send you one.
The Homes hosted a variety of guests in September of 1929, and their visits were detailed in the October newsletter. They shared a letter of thanks from one of the visitors from a Des Moines congregation. Mr. H.C. Braun wrote, "Dear sir, the pastor, members of the church board, along with the delegates from the Sunday school teachers, Luther League, Ember Club girls, forest rangers, and individual members of St. Paul's of Des Moines wish to thank Superintendent Reverend Klein and his good wife for the royal reception and entertainment accorded us on our recent trip to our homes at Muscatine. We left Des Moines at 3 p.m. in a 32-passenger bus and some private cars, arriving at the Homes about 10:30 that evening. After registering, we were assigned to our quarters, the ladies in the new dormitory for girls, and us boys over in the old building with the boys. Many of us rose early Sunday morning and went out to inspect the fields and farm, after which we had breakfast with the children. We were then shown around the buildings and grounds and found everything was very neat and clean. What a pleasure it was to see the happy faces of the children when they were promised a ride in the big bus. They were loaded in and taken for a ride through Muscatine. I don't know who received the most enjoyment out of that ride, the children or us grown-ups, for it made us all happy. The new dormitory is a wonderful building, and Reverend Klein certainly deserves great credit for the many, many things which were accomplished at so low a cost. Yes, Des Moines went and it saw. Now it believes. If others would go and do likewise, the worries of the superintendent would be greatly lessened. For we know that the ones who were fortunate enough to make the trip will never forget our homes at Muscatine and the work that is being done there. We again thank one and all for the courtesy and kindness shown us. Now for a home for the superintendent and his family. Yours sincerely, H.C. Braun.
Eventually, the superintendent and his family would get their own home in town, but that would not happen during the time that the Kleins were there. The Kleins remained in their apartment on the second floor of the old folks' home for 20 years. The Holmes also hosted a church convention with 90 guests. Reverend Klein wrote, "We hope this convention will make us many friends and be of lasting blessing to our homes. We also hope that they will invite us to come to them and give us an opportunity to present the cause of our institutions and help us raise money to liquidate our debt. Several of the ministers have invited us to do so, and we are expecting other invitations. We are always more than glad to accept such invitations, for we must get rid of our debt if the institutions are to develop. The more debts we pay, the sooner we will be able to banish the wolf of interests, which is now unbidden eating the food of the children." Reverend Klein highlighted two special guests, two of the former children who made their home there for about 7 years, a brother and a sister named Willis and Marie. They were all grown up, and Marie was now married. Reverend Klein wrote, "For quite a while, they were homesick for their old home and their mama, Miss Louise Wittig, so they decided to spend their vacation here. It was a happy reunion for all of us, and only too soon came the day of parting. After his return to Chicago, Willis wrote us a letter, which we think you will enjoy reading. Dear Reverend Klein, just a few words to let you know that I arrived home safely. I was terribly homesick after I left the home Saturday, and just as soon would have turned back as not. I enjoyed this vacation more than any other I ever had, hoping to see you next summer or sooner. Yours truly, Willis." Reverend Klein added, "We would only add to this letter that Willis has learned the plumbing trade, while his sister Marie is a stenographer in a large wholesale house in Chicago."
In previous episodes of the podcast, we've noted some newspaper stories from the 1920s that may seem odd or inappropriate by today's standards. There are plenty of examples of this practice regarding people filing for divorce. Newspapers in the 1920s often contained detailed information regarding who filed for divorce and why. Here are two examples from a Davenport, Iowa newspaper from 1929. The first headline read, "Nerves wrecked by quarrels, wife asking a divorce, complaining that her nerves are shattered and her health impaired as the result of 2 years of constant quarrels instigated by her husband. Charlotte Irene Cruz, wife of Carl Raymond Cruz, filed suit today for divorce, alleging cruel and inhuman treatment." Another headline read, "Says husband was indifferent, asks a divorce. Mrs. Mabel Pearl Schultz, wife of Frank Frederick Schultz, has filed suit for divorce, alleging cruelty, non-support, and desertion. Schultz, according to his wife, treated her coldly and indifferent. She asks custody of their child and a $15 a week alimony." Here is another example from the October 15, 1929 Muscatine Journal. "Two wives, Roberta M. Berg and Ethel B. Lawson, ask divorce decrees in petitions filed in district court this afternoon. Roberta Berg alleges cruelty in her suit against Edward A. Berg. The couple was married April 30, 1927, living together until October 10th this year. She asks the court's permission to use her maiden name. Ethel B. Lawson alleges her husband refused to be companionable and devoted his companionship to other female friends in her suit against Ray H. Lawson. She asks the court for custody of their minor son, $25 a month for his support, and $25 a month for alimony in addition to attorney fees."
Occasionally, there were also news stories regarding the circumstances surrounding children being placed at the homes. In October of 1929, readers of the Muscatine Journal were very interested in the plight of two siblings, Karma Jean, age 3, and Sonny Boy, age 1. The headline of the journal read, "Place children in church home. Judge Jackson signs order removing two from care of Elsie Lord." The article said, custody of Lena Louise, better known as Karma Jean, and Howard Sunny Boy Alloway, was given to the Lutheran Orphans Home on the Burlington Road with permission to adopt them out in an order signed by Judge D.V. Jackson today. The article went on to detail the children's circumstances. Their father had been committed as an inebriate, and somehow they ended up being cared for by a woman named Elsie Lord. It doesn't appear that Mrs. Lord was related to the children, but she went to court to keep them instead of the children going to the homes. The court denied her request, and the article noted, "Mrs. Lord, who has gained recognition through her marriage record and has figured in police court on several occasions, is facing charges of maintaining a liquor nuisance." The paper had referred to the nuisance as a bootlegger's resort.
The brother and sister were mentioned several times in the home's newsletter, and readers learned about their path to adoption. In October of 1929, the newsletter said, "Sunny Boy and his sister Karma Jean were turned over to us last week by order of court with the privilege of finding them a home somewhere. We have found a home for Sunny Boy in Chicago, and he will be taken there as soon as the matters have been settled with the state of Illinois. Karma Jean is also available for adoption, and we are seeking a Christian home for her. She is not quite 3 years old." This from December of 1929. Sunny Boy has received a new suit from a friend in Mendota. He wore it today for the first time when he left for Chicago, where a family has adopted him. Sunny Boy was the pet in the Reinemund Memorial Home. Many tears were shed today. Especially did it nearly break Miss Wittig's heart when she said farewell to him. She and we all are satisfied because we know that he has found a good home with a Christian family. We hope that John William, for that is the name we gave him here when we baptized him, will grow up to be a joy to his new parents and credit to our homes. In April of 1930, Reverend Klein explained that when the opportunity arose, they would visit the homes of the children who had been adopted, and on this occasion they visited Sunny Boy. Reverend Klein wrote, "We were glad to find the boy well and to know he had found a very splendid home." The October of 1930 newsletter noted that Karma Jean, now age 4, had gone to a family in Nebraska. Karma Jean's family sent a letter to the homes. It read, "Dear Reverend Klein, Karma Jean has received her package and is proud of her dolly and also likes her new dress stockings. If you have an opportunity, I wish you would thank the lady for Karma Jean and her new parents. She has been a very good girl, and we are thankful that the Lord has given her faith in us. I know it is another prayer answered, for I prayed so hard it would not be hard for her to come and live with us. We have 3 little kittens, and she likes them very much. And the last few days, she has made up with her daddy. We are indeed happy."
But back to the news story about Karma Jean and Sunny Boy being taken from a woman named Elsie Lord. What did the paper mean when it said that Mrs. Lord had, quote, "gained recognition through her marriage record"? An article from later that year in December of 1929 would tell the rest of the story and would explain why the plight of the two children was of such interest to the people of Muscatine. The headline in the Muscatine Journal read, "Much married, widowed, and divorced Elsie Lord takes seventh fling at marriage." It turns out at age 33, Mrs. Lord got married for the 7th time and became Mrs. Flesher. She had been divorced 4 times and had 2 husbands die. The paper took quite a comic take on Miss Flesher's fortunes and misfortunes, but some might even feel sorry for Elsie after hearing her story. Here's what the article said. Ancient astrologists and other seers were popularly supposed to pin much faith in the mystic numeral 7, and if their beliefs were well-founded, Elsie Hesse, Larson, Smith, Crossley, Seaman, Metzger Lord, who today married James G. Flesher, may have discovered her life mate, for Flesher is husband number 7 of the much married, widowed, and divorced Mrs. Lord. Elsie's marital history has been one of tyings and untyings, the untyings being accomplished by diverse means. On 4 occasions, the courts have assisted in relieving Elsie of the bonds which she found irksome. Upon 2 other occasions, the grim hand of death took her mates from her. The next part of the article was entitled, "If at first, ... and then went on to detail each of her prior marriages, including one which ended when her husband drank poison in a hotel room. We don't know what happened to Elsie, but her marriage in December, after having Karma Jean and Sunny Boy taken away earlier in the fall, indicates she moved forward with her life.
Reverend Klein closed his October column with news that the girls had moved into the new dormitory. It was quite a solemn occasion when our girls moved into their new home. With the singing of the hymn, "Jesus Still Lead On," the procession of girls entered the Bethany home. We spoke briefly using the story of Mary and Martha, then closed with a prayer that the Triune God would hold his sheltering hand over all those who would live here. We pray that the Lord our God, who has led us so many years and has blessed us so abundantly, will bless us and keep us during the coming years. "Jesus Still Lead On" was a popular standard hymn for the times. Here are the lyrics of the first two verses. "Jesus, still lead on till our rest be won. And although the way be cheerless, we will follow calm and fearless. Guide us by your hand to our fatherland. If the way be drear, if the foe be near, let not faithless fears o'ertake us. Let not faith or hope forsake us. For, though many a woe, to our home we go." The story of Mary and Martha is a familiar one. Mary and Martha were the sisters of Lazarus, who, according to the Bible, Jesus raised from the dead. The story about the sisters is found in Luke chapter 10. "Now as they went on their way, Jesus entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving. And she went up to him and said, 'Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her to help me.' But the Lord answered her, 'Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her.'"
We have no way of knowing why Reverend Klein chose the story of the sisters as the girls entered their new home, but it's safe to say that the girls may have felt like Martha on occasion. They may have been troubled and anxious like her. They had a great deal of responsibility, whether it was watching younger children, assisting with meals and laundry, or even helping when guests like the church members from Des Moines came for a visit. The Bible story Reverend Klein selected really highlights the foundation of Lutheran theology, which is justification by grace through faith. Martha's good works were not enough. For the girls, perhaps Reverend Klein's message was that all of the tasks and acts of service would not save them. Instead, it would be their faith. As the end of the month approached, the children would have been very excited about Halloween. The traditions at the homes surrounding the holidays gave everyone something to look forward to. It appears that the teachers from the school were in charge of the Halloween celebration, which occurred each year on the last Friday of October in the basement of the school. The little children had a party during the afternoon, and the older children had a party at night. Although a detailed description from Halloween of 1929 wasn't provided, we have lots of examples from other years. For example, Halloween of 1935 was described in the newsletter this way. "Another gay event during the month was the Halloween party. This is the one night of hilarious gaiety, and perhaps it is just as well that this day comes but once a year." The description of Halloween in 1936 had a bit more detail. "The annual Halloween masquerade party, an event which the children always anticipate with keen enjoyment, was held in the basement of the schoolhouse on Friday evening, October 30th, sponsored by our teachers. As in former years, everyone was attired in the most grotesque and ridiculous costumes possible. After due consideration, Mrs. Klein and Mrs. King, who acted as judges, selected our secretary, Miss Lau, as the winner of the prize for the best costume. It is our opinion that the judges, in determining their choice, most certainly did not have an eye for beauty. Having unmasked, the remainder of the evening was spent in playing games and in contesting for prizes of various sorts. After the refreshments, consisting of pumpkin pie a la mode, were served, the festivities came to an end, and another Halloween party had passed from reality to recollection."
The most detailed description we found came from Halloween in 1939. Here's how the newsletter described it. "The word resourceful should be defined to mean the ability to meet conditions as they exist and bring them to a successful termination. The writer would use it in that sense in trying to tell you about our teachers, Mrs. Bucca, Longlet, and Weiss, arranging and managing our 1939 Halloween party. This was their first attempt here at the Holmes, and they did a very good job of it. We speak of the proverbial new broom, but if the teachers can manage to cram something into the heads of the schoolchildren as well as they manage the party, we will say at the close of the school year, speaking in the vernacular, we think we have something there. The party was a great success, and as is usual at Halloween parties, ghosts and curiosity predominated. Early in the evening, Reverend Klein paraded the masked children through the old folks' building to let them see the antics and grotesque figures. The writer himself prides himself on knowing personally all the members of this household, but sitting on the sidelines in the spacious playroom of the school, where the masters were milling and marching around, I soon found I knew none. To describe each member and costume, well, it can't be done. Herbert Klein had the most grotesque makeup. Had he worn a skirt, I should call him a hula hula girl, but instead he wore oversized trousers and used the hula skirt as hair and whiskers, just a matter of moving them from the waist to the head. A gentleman and lady about equal in height, the lady was a perfect 48 or 50 now in real life. Mrs. Thalaker was a perfect 36. It was she who was the 300-pound woman. I did not find out until the next day that her well-groomed companion was Mrs. Martin's. As they paraded around, I tried to guess two ladies dressed in stylish 1800 AD streetwear. I flashed my light on them repeatedly, and when I finally spotted the well-groomed feet, I thought those feet fit only two people that I know of, namely Miss Bergansky and Miss Dietz. But I still couldn't believe that it was actually them, but banished the idea it was the two ladies mentioned.
Leon Stahl and Walter Freebus had a dandy makeup as Papa, Mama, and the baby and took one of the prizes. Freddie Messner had on my nightshirt with trousers rolled up to show his bare legs and a fireman's cap with a badge. He looked ready for any emergency. Jack Carter had on my overalls, stuffed out to a perfect question mark, resembling Mr. Wick with a ragland overcoat. He walked very stooped and wobbly on account of the excess weight he had to carry. I didn't look too much at him because I could see myself depicted 10 years from now. Two debonair, well-groomed gentlemen in black frock suits with black fedoras to match and pipes in their mouths, walking arm in arm, brought up the rear and offered a fitting appendix to the grotesque figures going before. It took the onlooker some time to spot them, but it was Miss Bucca and Miss Longlet. Miss Weiss was dressed as a demure old lady, quietly watching the others and seemed to say, "Well, well, this younger generation must have its fling." The other two prizes went to Herbert Klein and to Anna Mae Vestein and Jeanette Navziger, who were dressed as the little old country doctor and his wife. After unmasking games for the children were begun, and from reports, they all had a rousing good time. Besides the games, arrangements had been made for a ghost walk, which, as everyone will tell you, was very exciting and very spooky. Dandy refreshments helped to top it all off. One by one, the adults made their exit, leaving the children to enjoy their games. This ended another Halloween party, and the children are now looking forward to the ever-glorious Christmas time with its blessings and goodwill toward men.
The end of October 1929 brought Black Thursday on October 24th and Black Tuesday on October 29th, as millions of shares of stock were traded and prices were falling. But this was only the beginning. Over the next weeks, stocks would rally and then fall again as pundits and politicians tried to figure out what it all meant. Despite carrying news of a selling panic on Wall Street on October 24th, the Muscatine Journal carried more optimistic headlines on October 25th, such as, "Believe Wall Street slump may aid business," and "Stock market not barometer of prosperity. Official Washington says business is healthy." And even on October 29th, the byline was, "Billions lost during selling in early hours," but the headline read, "Stock market rallies." It wouldn't be until 1932 that the stock market would actually hit its low point, having lost more than 80% of its value. The news of the day reveals that the people of 1929 were only beginning to realize what we would now know in hindsight, that the events of October would lead to 10 years of unemployment, bank failures, and families being thrust into poverty. On October 31st, 1929, news of the stock market was overtaken by news of two ships colliding on Lake Michigan in the fog. There were 9 fatalities, but the wreck is better known for the cargo one of the ships carried, 268 Nash Motors automobiles. The cars were headed for Detroit, but now sit to this day on the bottom of Lake Michigan. The site of the shipwreck with its vintage cars was added to the National Register of Historic Places in April of 2016. On October 31st, 1929, this was the story that dominated the headlines.
As you recall, at the conclusion of one of the Halloween descriptions from the newsletter, the writer noted that the festivities came to an end and the party had passed from reality to recollection. That's the feeling we got from October of 1929. The world had changed, but just how much it had changed, although clear to us now, was not immediately apparent to those living through it. And the news of the volatile markets would share the front page, with rockets soaring and ships colliding, and also the postponement of the Muscatine corn husking contest because of possible snow and colder weather. Regardless of what was happening in Washington, D.C., or New York City, or around the world, life in Muscatine and on Burlington Road was headed for November. Final preparations for a long winter were being made, and Thanksgiving planning had begun. We hope you join us for episode 12 as we learn about life at the Holmes in November of 1929.
This podcast was researched and hosted by Andrew Newell and Karen Thaliker, and sound was edited by Robert Newell. Special thanks to Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa, for the use of their podcast studio.
If you have additional stories and information about the Lutheran Homes of Muscatine from 1921 through 1941, please send us a direct message on our Instagram at Life at the Homes.